is the Liminalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsey talking to Kelvin Gregory.
Listen to the recent podcast of the video conference, and because the themes seemed relevant in terms of exposure and wanting to make a good impression and nervousness, stage fright.
Right.
And particularly so because this is the first time I've used Skype, and I tend to shun social media in general. I don't have a Facebook account, and I'm even thinking about buying a new laptop that has privacy features. So, example, if you search the internet, it goes, instead of going directly to the internet, it bounces you through a network of nodes so that people can't trace back who you are and that sort of thing. I listen regularly to the internet, Intercept. It's a news outlet, and they're really quite into fighting the NSA, technologically, with the latest in technology and security features. But I suppose if you want to be completely invisible, you just have to dispense with the internet, which is hard to do.
Yeah. Well,
because I listen to your podcasts. There's three regular podcasts I listen to. Occasionally, James Howard Kunstler's. And John Zerzan out of Eugene, anarcho-primitivist.
Well, that's good. I'm in good company. I mean, I don't know that second one, but it sounds better than the Higher Side Chats, which is, or Gordon White, or Rune Soup, or something, which is tends to be the other podcast that my listeners listen to.
Yeah, you mentioned Gordon White when I brought up Scarlet Imprint. And I haven't heard of him. I'm not really familiar with his work.
No, that's, well, just the more alternate perceptions kind of thing, which, whatever we're going to call that particular margin, which I made my home in and I've been trying to extricate myself from ever since.
Right. I've been in and out. I've tried occult rituals in the past, and I really can't say I've gotten any clear results. And also, I can't overcome my embarrassment at the ritual accoutrements and robes and vests and bell book and candle. I just find it really. What am I doing? I mean, especially since my background is in science. I have 2 degrees in, one in computer science, ironically, and the other in physics. So I go back and forth, but I'm still fascinated by the occult. But I think I take Morris Berman's approach. And I've mentioned him before. I don't know if he would be amenable to being a guest. But since currently he's pretty much into cultural criticism of the United States.
Yeah, I invited him, but he told me I had to read his latest book before he would come on. So
I see.
It didn't happen.
Right. Okay. I was a member of his blog, and he has a bit of an ego thing. I think he feels... he hasn't said this, but from his behavior, I think he feels marginalized as a writer, and part of his resentment toward the U.S. is because he didn't become more well-known, I think, than he wanted to, or that he thinks his work should be accorded more attention.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are various reasons. Chiefly, he left the United States for Mexico because he just found the DNA of this culture too toxic. The atmosphere. He was living in Washington, D.C. He said the social capital is entirely eroded. People are very indifferent, apathetic, if not outright hostile. And he said it was night and day when he moved to central Mexico. He just said, he just reported all these little incidents of people just saying hello or mm-hmm. explaining to him where the garbage is to be deposited, and a little girl helping him with groceries one day, which spilled out of his bag on its way to his apartment. He said, you know, you can't expect a little girl in the U.S. to do that, because their parents probably said, never talk to strangers. Don't talk to strangers. He said he just, so he felt, and he had a surge of creativity. He had been writing nonfiction, cultural fiction before, and then he started writing poetry and wrote a novel. So he felt it was the right move for him, and he only regrets that he didn't leave the U.S. sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't follow him or his blog, but I've read some of his books. My wife checks in at his blog regularly, and she's given me more or less an idea of his personality and kind of orneriness, and I mean enjoyably ornery kind of guy. And I didn't take it as ego. I just took it as, well, I mean, he's just got boundaries there, and he obviously didn't feel he had time to check out my podcast or what I was doing. He just treated it as a normal interview request, and that's perfectly reasonable. Sure. To say, read my book if you're going to interview me. So
right, exactly. So it's more like promotion of his work and his projects.
Yeah,
and I noticed that with some of your guests. For example, I listened to all four podcasts involving Jonathan Lethem, especially because of having read Seen and Not Seen. I felt, wow, this is a very important figure in your life and your work. And so I owed it to myself to listen to all four podcasts. And I would almost say, well, naturally, he almost self-referential. He didn't quite get into the improvisatory exchange or talk about the larger issues outside his own work.
Yeah.
But I really liked him a lot. I liked the fact that he talks about his characters as if they were other people.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the creator's prerogative. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, it might have been partly on my side too, that because I did feel, compared to some other guests who do, and quite rarely, but you know, sometimes they do have a platform and they do sort of expect to be interviewed. I thought he was quite conversational, but yeah, we did keep the focus on our, you know, the area of overlap between our work. But I mean, I'm so interested in that and him as a writer and so on and so forth, as opposed to, as you're saying, just talking about the larger thing, you know, as two individuals. You know, my interest in Lethem, a lot of it does have to do with his status as Jonathan Lethem.
Yes, and that did come up. And in one part, I thought he was almost evincing a bit of irritation when he said, and you dared to, he used the word dare, and you dared to ask me to read your book or something. He didn't quite say that, but I remember the word dare, and I go, uh-oh. But then it kind of just, you know, it wasn't really what he was intending to say. I mean, it panned out that he's genuinely interested in your work.
Yeah.
And I like the ending of your book, the word from our sponsors, because it reminds me of something you said within the text, which I wrote down, that really struck me, hit a chord with me. I didn't write down too many notes because I didn't really want to be anchored to other people's words so much. But, oh yeah, here it is. It's right in front of me. If we don't find the right social environment, the right people and surroundings to express the innermost self and discover who and what we really are, we will remain an unrealized project, lingering our lifetime away in development hell. I really like that. Hmm. I can relate to that very much. And a quote occurred to me when I read the, and now a final word from our sponsors at the end of the book, in the sense that Lethem is for you a kind of sponsor,
mm-hmm.
at least in terms of your professional writer status.
Right.
Oh, by the way, I found both volumes of Blood Poets in our university library under Jake Horsley, so...
Well, good thing they're under Jake Horsley and not under Pauline Kael. Yeah, that's amazing.
I didn't know it was a two-volume work, so that's very impressive.
Probably not heavily annotated, I'm guessing.
I noticed that the library is becoming digital. First of all, not many books were checked out to begin with, which I can understand would justify oneself, maybe pilfering a few volumes. Nobody's ever going to read these.
Uh-huh.
And most people use it as a study hall, and then they're glued to their laptops. You know, anything they want, they can read. And I noticed that instead of ordering new physical volumes, the library has many electronic resources, they call it. Electronic resource is in brackets next to a title. Like I looked up Leatham's The Gambler's Anatomy, and it was an electronic resource. I go, oh, shucks, I can't right. check that. Because yeah. I don't have I'm not a student, so I can't access their digital resources, for which they pay a big fee. And so they pass that on to student tuition, I imagine.
Right, so the Blood Poets have probably actually been languishing on those shelves for decades until you came along, quite possibly. Just the janitor dusting them at regular intervals.
Right. Well, they're expanding. The seventh floor of this library, they have an archive of Texana, and I noticed that they've removed more bookshelves in order to make room for the expansion of this archive, which had always been the head librarian's pet project. So she's really into it. She's not really into ordering what's called in library talk collection development. And I don't know, it may be true of many libraries that since Google is digitizing the world, you know, everything's going online.
Well, without going on that digression, it's occurring to me, I mean, just a little we've talked already, I mean, I guess I got this sense, but not so much, because you've been commenting at the blog for a while now, like months, years even?
Right, actually years. I'm one of the first, I think one of your early guests was George P. Hansen.
Number one.
That was when I first found out about you through, I don't know, I found out about you through JHK, Kunstler. So that was really early on. I probably listened to the archive.
You went back, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
But it was your first comment was actually on the Hansen thing, yeah.
Right.
After I talked to Kunstler, yeah. Right. So I mean, that what I was going to say I didn't finish, which is you don't seem to be a typical... of my listenership. Now, I'm always wary about statements like that because A, my listeners don't want to be thought of as typical of anything, and B, how do I know, you know? But generally the sense I get is I have a certain sort of listener, and you're not, you don't fit into that mold. Well, that was what I was going to say. And so it makes sense that you came through Kunstler, because I definitely have attracted some readers and listeners through him that are atypical. And what I mean by it specifically, I have to be careful about language, because that's right. What I was referring to before about the margin that I ended up being somewhat pigeonholed into. But also, I mean, I volunteered to enter into it as the alternate perceptions guy, or one of them, trying to extricate myself from that and be more mainstream, in the sense that someone like Berman or Kunstler is mainstream, and I don't mean necessarily more well known, I just mean as in writing for a larger spectrum of readers.
Yes.
Right? As opposed to those who are already signed up to a particular worldview, which includes UFOs, mind control, government conspiracies, etc. Right, that whole rota of stuff, which somebody like Morris Berman or James Howard Kunstler doesn't really have much time for, unless it's written by me. Well, Berman actually not interested in me, but Kunstler is interested in what I do, and it's been, and Leatham, it's been a really energizing challenge to see how well I can communicate these sorts of worldviews with these characters and their listeners or readers who are generally have dismissed that worldview as not so, right?
Right. I remember I made the mistake of writing writing a Maury, or I called him Maury. Maybe he didn't like that. That's how I always addressed him on the blog. Yeah. I wrote Maury a letter, which was kind of involving, because at the time I was involved in these, this group on the internet that was following the work of Joseph Lisiewski, or Lisiewski, who had a brief foray into the occult publishing, was soundly trounced by the New Agers because half the content of his books was a polemic against the New Age and, you know, to get back to real magic, or what he called old system magic, by which he meant evocation of demons. And he had annotated, his most famous book is, I can't remember the title, but it was an annotation of a medieval work by Peter de Abano, which is a ritual for evoking these beings, and, you know, includes a circle, a protective circle, and invocation of the angels of the four quarters. Mm-hmm. And I was involved with them, and somehow I got spooked, and I needed some kind of reassurance, or how am I going to get out of this? These people are attacking me or something. Mm-hmm. So in this state of mind, I wrote Berman a long letter based on the fact that he, although he is very hard-headed and rational, mm-hmm. he's written a trilogy of consciousness, the first title of which is The Reenchantment of the World, yeah. where he talks about possible, you know, well, this worked for them in their worldview.
Yeah.
But he understandably responded curtly, saying that, Kelvin, I just, or he always called me Kel, I just don't have time to respond to a screed like this, and I apologize. And then he immediately wrote back, try this book and try this title. So mm-hmm. he's a bit gruff, but I'm not sure where I was going with this.
What did he recommend?
Excuse me?
What did he recommend, the titles?
I can't remember it, what it was, but his view is complicated, dialectical, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been, like you, I can relate, this was a point of interest in your work, was your extricating yourself. But I don't believe I have been as heavily invested as you were in the occult or in some shamanic journey. I've always dabbled in my my embarrassment and my skepticism usually gets the better of me.
Right.
And I feel I get spooked, though, and it can scare me away. But at the same time, I think I've had spontaneous experiences, you know, in your questionnaire about perceptions, any unusual perceptual problems or experiences.
The general, the early questions.
Right,
to me.
That's right, your questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, throughout my childhood, up in, not recently, but through my, up to the age of 25, I guess culminating in the volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens, which I guess I would say, you know, if I'll talk the language of the occult, that it pretty much turned my aura ragged. The blast blew my aura to shattered my aura, or just made it into tatters.
Between being well and being ill, that's what Julia told me, and I know she always will. I'm falling now, I'm falling. there's a thin line between what you are and what you aren't. I'm afraid of loving you, and you're afraid I can't. I'm falling now, I'm falling. I'm falling.
So disorientated.
Were you in proximity or something?
No, not directly. I was south of the. I was in Portland, Oregon, and living in the basement of an old elder couple who actually owned a cabin at Spirit Lake, which was completely destroyed by the blast. As I've alluded to this in the comments, after the blast, I started experiencing very strange things. It was the middle of a Portland summer, yet I would report to my security job at the college where I was working that summer for money. I would be shivering to the point that my teeth were audibly chattering, and my coworkers would say, "What's wrong with you? You know, it's pretty warm. Are you cold?" I go, "I don't know. I just feel cold. I just can't help it." I would be shivering involuntarily, get off my shift, go back home, fall asleep, wake up, my body's still asleep, paralyzed, and panic a little, and until I learned how to negotiate that by just relaxing and just, "I'm going to get out of it. Don't worry. Nothing's going to happen." Except something did happen, and it was what I call my spontaneous astral projection. And I was floating above my body. At first I was looking at the ceiling of my basement apartment, and then I willed myself and said, "Well, I'm not in my body, so let me see if my body, this is the ceiling, it's not very far away from me, so let's see if I can turn around and see where I am." And I managed to turn rotisserie-like, as if I were on a spindle or something, and saw my body below me, and then snapped back into it, experienced the paralysis once more, and then just relaxed out of it, and became awake and was moving my limbs. And I haven't been able to explain that. I believe that it's maybe an aspect. It had a very real feeling to it, you know, what we usually... Mm-hmm. I think we can tell what reality is. I mean, when we're awake, we feel there's a certain quality to it, and I felt something very similar with this out of body experience. That this is not, I'm not dreaming this. This feels real.
Mm-hmm. When did this happen?
When in the weeks after Mount St. Helens. So I was I think I was maybe 20 years old, 21.
So what year was that?
That would be 1979, I think, or 80. I think between 78 and 80.
Okay, that's when I was 13. So that's the seen and not seen period I'm addressing, and seen and not seen. Not that it's particularly relevant, but just to give you a bit of context or comparative context.
Yes, I think I'm probably the same age as your sister.
Yeah, and John DeRuta.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's turning 57 this year.
I'm 59.
Okay, a couple of years. So you're just coming through your second Saturn return, not to get pulled into an astrological tunnel, but and that was a standalone out of body experience.
That's the only one I really remembered, and aside from that, the sleep paralysis continued, accompanied with very technicolor dreams, very violent dreams, which my analyst interpreted as, "Oh, that's the primal scene, you know, my parents having sex."
A Freudian, then.
Yes, he was a Freudian analyst. I saw him for 4 years or 5 years, twice a week, and I only seemed to get worse after. So, I mean, he did change me, but I think it was for the worse. So he was effective. I mean, he effected change of some sort.
So you abandoned the therapeutic project?
Yes, and then I returned to occultism because I thought, well, maybe the occult, I could view it as a way, you know, especially the Jungian flavor, as a way of self-therapy.
Yeah, well, that's what John Michael Greer compares occultism to, the psychological path.
I haven't read any of his books except for his nonfiction book on alternate technology or ecological matters. And he was another blog. I would attend his peak oil discussions and things of that nature. But no, the authors I've read in the occult, well, Crowley, but never really got into him. Although in high school I read his entire hagiography, as he called it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a slog.
Mm-hmm.
Reams of bad poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was fascinating, and I was quite heavily into him. So that was one text I read, and I've read around in Magic Without Tears. I can't read his main magic book. I don't. It doesn't really attract me. So other people were Donald Tyson, Canadian. He's actually the only one who's published a very thorough, detailed workbook. Aside from this German guy whose work has been usually endorsed as a great training manual. I can't remember his name.
Not Schertl, is it?
No, I don't think so.
That's the one that Hitler wrote. So
oh, okay.
Not, yeah. Yeah.
But right now, I'm pretty much in your camp. I'm still wrestling with the idea of social engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And my feeling about it is that it's impossible to extricate oneself, that in a sense we're doomed.
Mm-hmm.
we can't get out of the matrix, or maybe not all of us, and you worried me a little when you said after a certain age it might not be a thing to do, or it might be impossible to do, it may kill you.
When did I say that?
Or maybe I'm not sure where I found that. It might have been in Seen and Not Seen. Yes, it's in Seen and Not Seen.
What was I referring to? What was the context?
Doesn't occur to me now.
I don't remember writing anything about they might kill you if you extricate. It doesn't sound like maybe
okay.
Matrix Warrior, possibly.
You may have been paraphrasing someone else then. Oh, or you might have been paraphrasing someone in the film. But yeah. You do mention the Matrix several times. Seen and not seen.
Uh-huh.
So
well, that is in the Matrix, yeah, that you can't be unplugged after a certain age.
That's probably what it was then.
Yeah, because the mind fights too much, resists too much.
I was going to mention that I found your book compelling and a page-turner, as I told you, but which is surprising because I haven't seen many of the films. Like Pauline Kael, I've never been interested in Westerns. They've always kind of turned me off. As a child, I would watch Roy Rogers. I remember, and but I never really took to Westerns. So only a few of the films I've seen. I haven't seen any of the Peckinpah films, but I've seen Unforgiven. I liked it at the time. I have a list of the films here. So I have a lot of homework to do.
Maybe.
The key films are The Searchers, The Wild Bunch, Where Eagles Dare, Dirty Harry, I've seen Midnight Express. I saw it when it first came out. We were given a free screening as college students, and I remember the guy I was with was a Herzog fan, and so I started learning about Werner Herzog mm-hmm. in the context of having seen that in Midnight Express. And I think we agreed, oh yeah, that's a great film, but I think you really exposed, and Cale as well, exposed the kind of hypocrisy and social engineering and Hollywood as part of the military establishment, the Hollywood military complex,
mm-hmm.
which I can see. I agree with you there.
So I don't want to interject because it felt like you were on your way to a point, but because you were going to say you found it a page turner, but...
Oh, I did? Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I didn't mean... I'm not sure what that but was heading toward. And then, of course, the final quarter with your brother, that I found very moving. Shocking. You know, you didn't hold back, and you mentioned, that your wife had concerns about you revealing that certain incident involving the cellar in Amsterdam. But it didn't. I didn't feel alienated or turned off, nor did I feel turned on necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Although I can relate to the sexualized stimulation from violence, I can understand that.
Well, somebody else read that, but not somebody who was generally interested in my work per se, and definitely not into movies, but she was going to help promote the book just because she wanted to help me. But then when she got to the last part about Sebastian, she was so turned off that she said she couldn't help with the book.
Right.
Like, she just found it, like, she thought I should just cut it all out because it was so dark.
I guess the way I rationalized it or coped with it, you have a trigger warning in italics before that chapter, I believe. Mm. And the way I saw it was, well, the amputee was there, I suppose, by her own consent. She agreed to be there. She.
Well, you know, that incident never happened, though. I don't think I knew that but when I finished Seen and Not Seen, but I later found out that the photograph that my brother sent around of him supposedly having sex with an amputee was photoshopped.
Yeah, you do mention that in the book, but you said that in the book you say you used that to reassure your mother, to console your mother, that you said that.
No, I thought that when I saw it, or maybe it was photoshopped, then Sebastian said no, it wasn't. But since I finished Seen and Not Seen, or soon after, his oldest friend said, no, I know it's photoshopped, because A, he knew that Sebastian didn't have that large a penis, and B, he had actually found the original photo.
Oh, okay.
It was a porn photo with exactly the same, except with a different head on the body. So unless somebody right. photoshopped Sebastian's image, then Sebastian had made that up. So that actually strengthens my feeling that he was hiding something else, because I think that he made up the amputee thing because he couldn't testify to what he was really doing in Amsterdam, because it would have been illegal. That's my guess. So he wanted to come up with something that was really shocking, but that he wouldn't, you know, be legally answerable for.
In the book, though, you do say that your first reaction was that it was photoshopped.
Yeah, well, right, or at least my first sort of desperate clutching at straws thought. It wasn't right. that I looked at it and thought, that looks fake.
Maybe as a defensive reaction.
Yeah, it's just clutching at straws. Yeah. I mean, well, it wasn't, as it turned out. It was a real life raft, but But who knows, you know? Like, some in my body, I would have known, I suppose, that that was fake.
Are you planning on, if there's a second edition of the book, will you put that in?
Yeah, I would. I'd also fix the bit that says that David Icke outed Jimmy Savile, because apparently that's a lie that David Icke has fomented.
Oh, okay.
Apparently he didn't actually talk about Jimmy Savile before it came out.
When you this book has been published, did you have concerns about legal actions against you?
Around my brother or who?
Well, yeah, I noticed that you say things like allegedly. You're careful to say allegedly.
Oh, because of Garley and because of the people involved.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
Your,
no, I was.
Your brother's handlers, as you.
Yes. I was concerned. I mean, yeah, somewhat. I was aware of that.
I imagine because they did behave rather viciously toward you in terms of borrowing you from the funeral and basically sidelining you or attempting to.
Yeah.
It sounds like, and if you know, Garley did put your brother up to the 500 pounds and the, you know, here, go have fun in Amsterdam and tell me about it.
She wouldn't mind that. I don't think she'd object to that. Well, anyway, that's in his memoir, so she'd have had to sue him.
Right.
And she inherited his estate, and so all the money.
Well,
from
I guess my point was that you're dealing with people who may not, you know, who may be difficult and dangerous if they want to be.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know how explicit I was in Seen and Not Seen. I went more explicit with Occult Yorkshire because, I mean, that. You know, I was writing Seen and Not Seen as an extended response to Leatham. It began really as a response to him, and then it just kept expanding into this ongoing exploration, which at a certain point I realized, okay, this is a book, probably very early on, okay, I'll make this a book. And then at a given point, somehow, I started realizing I was going to have to look at Sebastian and his life, the glamour, magic aspect. And so then it was almost like, it was like losing control of a vehicle, you know, suddenly you hit a patch of ice or a swampy thing or whatever, and you think, well, I'm not sure if actually I'm going to be able to, you know, make it through this patch to the other side so that I can actually finish the journey. I wasn't sure if I would be able to finish the book because it had gone so deep and so dark so fast. Was I actually going to be able to bring it back up after that to more or less the same tone and style and focus as before?
Right.
So that last chapter was the hardest, and it was actually Leatham who said, oh, you need something at the end to bring it back around, you know, to tie it up with where you started, otherwise you're leaving the reader kind of, you know, lost in some twilight zone, which it's like the end of the Twin Peaks there.
Right.
You know, before the return. Anyway, just to finish, and I managed to do that, but I knew I wasn't finished with what I'd started with Sebastian, so that was the genesis of Occult Yorkshire, which just started as a thread at Rigorous Intuition and then eventually became the series at the blog, and then it's now a book that's finished. But so then that was when I uncovered the deep background for Sebastian's self-destruction and his behavior. And although I didn't return to Sebastian and his death and Garley and all those people, I think it does, the depth of the background of my own family history does strengthen the possibility that the people that Sebastian was surrounded by were handlers in some literal sense. That was the point I wanted to make in a very long, roundabout way.
No, I understand. In my typos, I included a few comments trying to tie together thematic various themes. And one of them was that as the women in the Maquiladoras were handled, so are Hollywood actors.
Oh, and the counselor, the maquinadoras,
yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I felt that is a good. So it points to the to the unity of the book, how it really does tie together. In my mind, the peak characters or the main protagonists are, well, aside from yourself, it would be Clint Eastwood, Pauline Kael, and your brother.
Mm.
And then, furthermore, when you explore the controversy between Kael and Eastwood, that ties them together. So there's a unity to the book, in spite of its complexity. It's something I pointed out. And I think you refer back to earlier writing, like the Blood Poets, and revise them.
That was particularly enjoyable, yeah. It's got every writer wants to be able to do, I suppose. It's kind of redeem right. The early folly. You forgot Leeson, by the way, as the main character.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. He kicked it off.
Yeah, he kicked it off, and he's there at the end, literally. He actually makes a cameo appearance at the end, like in a Woody Allen movie.
Right, yeah. Purple Rose of Cairo.
Yeah.
And grab him off the screen.
And he's like, he's the good brother. I mean, that, I don't know how explicit I am, but he's like the brother that, you know.
Oh, no,
I didn't
that
have.
Came out. Yeah. Yes, that's very clear. Mm. That's right. Now you're calling.
Take it away. Take it away.
Grappling with the book, and I think with its basic, I think the basic theme or the thesis of social engineering and how our consciousness is populated by culture. And I'm ambivalent about that because I see myself, although not into pop culture as you are, I was always a bit of a snob, a culture snob, indoctrinated with this idea of the great books. Mm. In fact, one of my favorite one of my heroes in my youth was Mortimer J. Adler, who coined the term great books and who founded a college, or was instrumental in establishing St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. There's a campus in Santa Fe as well. And the program is completely, the undergraduate program is completely prescribed, and it's a list of great books. You know, and you read your way through Western, the heights of what, the peaks of Western culture. And the first 2 years you're taught French, and the last 2 years you're taught Greek, ancient Greek. So I really that really appealed to me, and I've tried to give my, although I didn't have an education quite like that, I've tried to be an autodidact and give myself that education. But Adler, and this connects with Jan Ervin, Adler was a promoter of the seven liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium. Although I don't think he would agree with Ervin's application of them, because Adler was very, very much a corporate man. He held what he called executive seminars and invited heads of corporations to adult reading circles around a particular great book, maybe probably political, Aristotle on politics or Machiavelli.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have ambivalence. I see myself as a culture vulture. And it started early on in my life. My first hero was Leonardo da Vinci. I wanted to be like him. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I could see the lack of focus in my own life as having too many interests, you know, and being arrogant enough to think that I can fit them all into one lifetime, which hasn't panned out very well. Now I feel like I can't remember what I read because I read too much. I don't have a detailed grasp of what I've read. So I've given up on trying to get that kind of specialist grasp. It's a academic kind of thing, and I was attracted to academia, but that didn't pan out. So,
yeah, well, I'm sort of a bit of a amphibian in that regard too, because I've written two books for academic presses, and you know, I did my best to really fake it in the Blood Poets. Like, I'd refer to Balzac and Dostoevsky. I didn't have. Well, neither of those did I have to fake. They're writers I love, but what I'm saying is, as I was aware of, yeah, I hadn't really read, and I still haven't really read that many of the classics. I'm not well read by any real standards. I mean, it depends whether you compare up or down, right? If I compare down, right, I'm very well read, but if I compare up, no, I'm just kind of more almost a dilettante in that regard. There are just certain officially great writers and so on and so forth that I have embraced. I've never read Joyce and so on and so forth. So in Blood Poets, I was aware of kind of gatecrashing academia and dropping the hints here and there that might create the impression that I was a highly cultured individual. In many ways I am, because I was raised in that milieu, but I've always, as Seen and Not Seen testifies, I've always been drawn to pulpier, what Leatham calls vernacular culture. So, you know, the more lowbrow kind of thing, even within the field of movies, I was, well, kind of both. I mean, I certainly never liked Bergman or Fellini or, you know, the filmmakers that are generally raised up, or Kubrick. Not sure where I'm going with this. I felt like I was going somewhere.
Well, we were talking about
being an amphibian, and I mean, I think it's interesting in comparison to the thing we were exploring at the beginning, which was the sort of loony fringe of alternate perceptions people versus the intelligentsia, Kunstler or Berman, who are not mainstream by any means, but they're respected within the mainstream debate in a way that John Irving, who's kind of pretty high status within the alternate perceptions community, he's got a large following anyway, or Chris Knowles or Gordon White, whatever, they're not. Obviously, you know, nobody's going to invite them to do a TED talk or be on a panel with Kunstler or John Michael Greer. Is interesting because he's kind of got his feet in both camps. Anyway, so those two worlds, the alternate perception / lunatic fringe with the intelligentsia, in a certain way you could compare those to what we're talking about here, which is what you're talking about, high culture and low culture. But they're not actually two worlds. I mean, so it's interesting, and this is the liminalism, or at least liminality, you know, is it possible to coexist in both worlds and recognize or show and demonstrate that there are only one world? So, and that's, I mean, I'd certainly say that, but we're talking about culture, like at what point does a you know, the whole elitist idea of culture, whether these greats and there's a pantheon of greats, does that merge and become inseparable from the vernacular culture, which is just, I don't know about art, but I know what I like. If it's popular, then it's good. They seem to be diametrically opposed, but you've got somebody like Scorsese or Coppola or whatever, who's, you know, which is it? You could say, well, it's movies, therefore it's kind of just pop culture, but Shakespeare was popular in his day.
Yeah, that occurred to me, yes. Often, that's the problem with high culture. It becomes enshrined behind a museum. Mm-hmm. And every, you know, like Mark Twain said of a classic, it's a book everybody knows about, but nobody's read. And I've tried to read them. I'm not very well read. In fact, I'm a slow reader, partly because I think I... well, when I was reading Seen and Not Seen, for example, I was reading it in your voice. I would hear your voice speaking to me in my head. I don't know, maybe this is typical of many people, but I know I can hear symphonies in my head. I have a very vivid aural imagination, as well as visual imagination. Sometimes I close my eyes and I can see very realistic people that I've never seen before. Hmm. Sometimes they'll distort into like those sketches of Leonardo's that are satirical and grotesque. They can morph into that. But when I was reading Seen and Not Seen, I'd hear your voice, especially when you were writing about your brother. I'd hear your voice, and then, but in other sections, I'd drop back to my usual voice of internal consciousness. I puzzle about that too. You know, thinking seem in with me anyway seems to be a continuous self-talking in a voice that I recognize as my own or that I call me.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I have so much of my identity anchored in this voice. And I've had the notion, I've never really effected it, of silencing it and then saying, who am I if I shut this voice off?
Mm-hmm.
And I made a comment in your blog, in the podcast comment section. I think I mentioned something about, I can't remember where it was, but I remember saying that when I'm running, because I've taken up running in the last few years, sometimes this voice is going on in my head as I'm running. I don't run with headphones or anything to distract me, and I run in a place that's very unpopulated, although ironically it's not away from civilization, it's like smack in the middle of it, but it's a very flat field with landscaping. And occasionally the voice will drop out and all I hear is my breathing, the sound of wind blowing past the shells of my ear, the sensation, the sound of my feet on the gravel.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could prolong it, but there's so much percolating inside all the time, and it comes out in my conversation. I imagine I'm I guess giddy about sticking to a point. What point was I making, by the way? But well, it's that internal voice that I believe is part of maybe the ego, what we invest as our sense of self.
It's part of socialization, absolutely, which brings us into autism, and as it's addressed in Seen and Not Seen also, like, you know, what would we be if we weren't colonized by culture, if we hadn't been socially engineered, which we think of as just being socialized, as you say. Like, we can talk about social engineering as this big woo conspiracy theory of secret societies, and it becomes easy to dismiss for those who haven't really either done the research or done the self-examination or both, who then, you know, because if you do, you realize that we're just talking about socialization, the thing that the water that none of the fish can see, because they've never known anything different.
I guess social engineering then begs the question, who are the engineers? And so it does kind of lend itself to a conspiracy slant.
It does, and it's not a wrong question, is it? If there's social engineering, there must be, it's like Charles Fort said, if there's honey, there's got to be bees. I think he said that, maybe it was me, but I know I quoted him.
Give
around
yourself
that. No, I think it was Aeolus Caphus, actually. You can't have sorcery without sorcerers. That was my frame of reference back then. Now it's social engineering. And bringing it back to culture high and low, I mean, maybe this will make sense, or I don't know yet because I haven't said it, but yeah. But, I mean, one of the... Have you read the ongoing post about Greg Desolate?
No, that's one thing I'm discovering. I've been mostly a podcast listener.
All right.
And I've been exploring the blog, and, well, which this is a digression, but I don't know how you can be so productive.
Yeah. Well.
It's the same for a volcano.
Yeah.
I can't keep up with you.
Soul's eruption. Yeah, well, I guess I'm so heavily socialized. I've got so much stuff to get out. I'm still trying to pull it out. Anyway, I brought that up because I read his books recently because he'd read The Blood Poets and he'd referenced it in his books, so that was how I discovered him. And then I read his books because he sent me copies, and it turned out they're about violence in movies, so obviously it's a subject that interests me, also about evil and how movies indoctrinate us with a way of thinking that reduces the possibility for real communication and understanding and non-violent, you know, disagreement and stuff. So he's talking about social engineering light. But one of the movies he singles out is Taxi Driver, which, as you know, is one of the key influences in my life. And, you know, as close as I would get to an example of great art would be Taxi Driver, at least a few months ago. Now everything is in doubt. Well, everything's been in doubt for a while, but you know, my relationship to Taxi Driver seems to have just deepened over the years, and my respect for it and so on, even within the context of movies of social engineering. Anyway, so, and he's an academic, and he's written this two-book thesis, maybe more than two books, about what constitutes great art versus melodrama. And his idea is that life is tragic and that great art has to be tragic. And he calls it synagonal conflict as opposed to antagonal. Antagonal is antagonism, it's good versus evil, exteriorized, whereas tragic or synagonal is internal struggles that, you know, have good character or, you know, rounded characters wrestling with their own weaknesses and so on and so forth. Can still have violent conflict, but it's always sourced internally, which obviously I agree with all of this. But he uses Taxi Driver as a negative example, whereas to me it's absolutely a positive example. So I can't separate with him. And the reason I'm bringing it up is that he's trying to come up with a template for what constitutes great art, which is what you just referred to, as versus popular culture. But I don't think you can do that. I mean, I think to some extent you can, but I think if you go back to the roots of great art, you'll find somebody like Plato, who wasn't, strictly speaking, an artist. He was a philosopher. This guy Greg's a philosopher too, and he's saying we need to use philosophy to improve our lives. Well, obviously, what else is it good for? Fair enough. But he also wants to apply it to the arts. Fair enough too, because if it's a good philosophy, you apply it to everything. And that's Plato. Like, Plato was using philosophy to regulate the arts, or at least so I've read. That was part of his agenda. And that's social engineering. If you want to trace social engineering, you're going to end up, not end, but you're going to reach Plato at a certain point. He's definitely one of the key players, right?
Right. In fact, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I think I've included my typos. They're not always a list of typos. I sometimes inject observations. One of them was, I was thinking as I was reading the book, oh, this is Jason's Republic, Plato's Republic, because in the Republic, Plato wanted to banish the artists. because he said that this reality, our own reality, is an illusion, and so why add more illusion? So he thought in order to get that reality, you had to banish artists and or at least censor them.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. But yeah, or not even, I mean, or at least censor them, or at least train them and make sure that they're doing it responsibly and doing it right in a way that doesn't inflame the passions and so on.
In addition to the movie theater being a very good analog to Plato's cave, because the prisoners are entertained by shadows on a fire, there's a fire behind them.
Absolutely.
So it's like projection of the image onto the screen. Very good, close analogy to Plato's cave.
Yeah, it is. And
I felt that the goal was to leave the cave and enter into the sunlight reality.
Yeah, so, but it is an assumption that we can't do. I mean, if reality is an illusion, which is a oxymoron, and I know you were paraphrasing, he wouldn't have said that, but it definitely, you know, that there's a big question mark there. Obviously, we would have to read Plato if we're going to refer specifically to that, but to the general idea that we're already dissociated, and movies, you know, are symptomatic of our dissociation and also help to perpetuate it, therefore get rid of movies. That doesn't really follow, because if we get rid of movies, it's not going to heal the dissociation, because they're evidence of our dissociation. So then they become maps, potentially maps back to reality, just as in the Matrix, the dream that they're all having, which is the Matrix, that they're the ones who are dreaming it, the sleeping pod people. So it would have clues to the fact that it's just a dream. So then the Matrix is actually, although it's trying to tell the sleepers who they are, and you can't believe that, it's also telling them you're sleeping and you need to wake up, because it can't help but do that, because it's using the unconscious. And so in that sense, you know, I'm not against, it's very interesting you said the Republic, because I in my response to Desolate, I accused him of working for Plato and trying to set up his republic. But he is actually more aligned with that kind of social engineering approach to writing, as in he wants to write a blueprint for a better world. Not, I mean, don't quote me on that. I'm sure he would object to that, putting it in such stark terms, but he is about social reform. So, and this brings me to where I was trying to get to all along, which is, if you want to say who are the social engineers, it's anyone who wants to make the world a better place, essentially, or at least anyone who's doing something about it. So, like, it's not such a bad, yeah.
I've been a liberal, and then I've been on the left, Marxist. I've read the first volume of Capital. And now I would say I have a lot of sympathy with anarcho-primitivism. John Zerzan's, he's the intellectual force behind, or spokespiece for that brand of anarchy, anarchism, I should say.
Yeah.
And the idea, the key term, the key villain in this ideology is domestication.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's into rewilding.
Right.
And,
Tyler Durden.
So typically he's been tracking mass shootings, especially in America, and the recent one. His last podcast, radio broadcast, which he collects in an archive. If you go to his website, you can access the archive. But he sees the latest massacre as, it's just of a piece. If you have civilization, you're going to have this. The solution is to go back before 10,000 years, before domestication, and ultimately, you know, that would be a solution. So it's like a regression, actually. And, you know, I have a lot of sympathy with it, because I guess I'm at heart, I feel a lot of sympathy. I grew up in a very, with the presence of nature very much in evidence. I grew up in the tropics, and our house was surrounded by the jungle. I always refer to it as the jungle. It's technically the rainforest, but jungle evokes more childhood. associations with me. And, you know, when I was alienated from my peers, I would head into the jungle. And I have one image of I'm in the jungle and I'm squatting and I'm surrounded by raindrops falling on these wet leaves, and I'm peering through the jungle and I see this, what we call bird of paradise. It's a plant with very delicate finger-like flower that's shaded red and fades into yellow, almost like what we call cotton candy around Halloween time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just staring at it, and that's it. It's a very tranquil feeling of beauty and pristine feeling, and I'm alone. Often my peak experiences or my experience of tranquility or transcendence usually don't involve another person. They have on occasion, but that's been very rare. When I've been in love, I guess, falling in love, I have that experience of a sort of tender communion, my environment, surrendering, or a sense of tranquility, serenity. So, I feel that's the ambivalence I feel. I have early impressions of nature, and I feel very consoled by nature. On the other hand, I realize that I don't think I could maybe spend a week, you know, in the jungle by myself, or even with a tent and supplies. In other words, survive. I don't know how I could do it, but
well, if you had a tent,
then it would become instrumental. It wouldn't become an aesthetic experience, right? Then you'd have to worry about food, shelter.
I think,
dangerous animals.
Absolutely.
So in other words, I'm romanticizing. It's an aesthetic.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the very sensibility that's created civilization in the first place, or at least the kind of mess.
Although Berman, in his last book the third book of the Trilogy of Consciousness is called Wandering God, A Study in Nomadic Spirituality.
Yeah.
And he believes that the wandering hunter-gatherer bands had, there's evidence that they had experiences of transcendence. I'm not sure of his argument there, but he's proudest of that book of the trilogy. He feels it's his most closely argued, although I would think that maybe there is a compositional flaw, because many of the big insights come in these huge, very long footnotes stuck in the back.
Well, I've always been opposed to the idea of transcendence, but ironically I used it recently in my piece about Greg Dessler, and his response was, "I don't believe in transcendence." So the shoe was suddenly on the other foot. I found that without realizing it, I'd used a concept that I generally never used. And the question, of course, is transcending what and to what? You know, what is a transcendent state?
It has that. I mean, etymologically, it means to ascend or to transcend, I guess, go across, go into another place.
Yeah.
But it could be, but it could be just a way of, it's one of those halo words, you know. It has a lot of, it depends on how you want to use it. You can use it in a very technical sense. For example, ecstasy means literally standing outside yourself.
Yeah.
And so some people prefer entasy, which is inhabiting yourself. But it could be, you could feel a feeling of transcendence, or what you associate with transcendence, by becoming more embodied.
Yeah. Well, that's where I was going to go with that. It seems that that was why I was against the idea of transcendence in the, you know, for most of my life, was it always suggested a rising above stuff, whereas I was always the sort of shamanic, scorpionic path of going deeper into, and I still am, but not necessarily with such a shamanic or a transformative kind of angle, because I think that's also, like the idea, I used to say not transcendence, transformation, but even the notion of transformation implies that we need to get past, or we need to enter into a new state, as opposed to just noticing what's already here and locking our attention in a way, or wedding our attention permanently with what is real, with reality, which doesn't involve transcendence. And maybe it involves personal transformation, in that one's persona or one's ego would be transformed in some weird way, but it wouldn't involve going off to another place. It would, as you say, it would just be becoming fully embodied, fully present. And I think that the idea of nature, to bring it back to that, my wife's often talking about how, you know, when people used to live off the land or survive in nature, they had no free time, they had no leisure time. It was just constant effort just to stay warm, to get food, you know, get rid of waste. All the basic functions of existence took up all the time and energy, and they would just be exhausted at the end of every day. So there's nothing very transcendent about that, on the contrary. And nothing particularly desirable, really. I mean, if there was, we wouldn't be, you know, so locked into the convenience of modern culture, and what it offers is leisure, right? So it seems to me that at least what I've been moving towards more isn't a return to nature in the external sense, but a return to my own nature. And that has to happen within civilization and all of its, you know, depravities, distortions.
Otherwise, I suppose if you're an anarcho-primitivist, you have to be very, very patient, because civilization's not going away anytime soon. So you'll have to be invested for the future of a future humans who might need to take that course. But we may be forced into it.
Well, we may, but
ecological disasters occur.
But I mean, just to use a simile or whatever that I've used many times before, like, if you took just two people off the, or whatever, a bunch of people, or if you reduced the whole human race to 12 people, let's say, it's possible the trauma would transform them so radically that they would create an entirely new kind of community. But it's also possible that, if barring that possibility, and that they just sort of didn't really notice or whatever, just got on and carried on as before, but just had to build a life from scratch, they'd still be carrying the same propensities for delusion that created the civilization that they are temporarily freed from. So it seems as though you can't put the blame on civilization per se and just think, well, if we could somehow extract ourselves from this, or if it were to collapse, then we'd return to being hunter-gatherers and would be at harmony with the universe and et cetera, et cetera. Because the thing in us that created the civilization in the first place would still be working away. Like, until that's been identified.
Right, until it passes out of memory, if there's no writing and history to keep it in the foreground of consciousness.
Well, that's assuming that it's... That's assuming that it... Sorry, what?
If we become an entirely oral culture.
Yeah, but that's assuming that it, whatever it is that we're talking about, and we don't know what it is, is based on memory, or, you know, as opposed to some physical defect, or, I mean, it could be human beings were just, you know, misdesigned. I don't believe that, but
you touched upon a conflict I have between trying to change the world for the better, trying to reduce carbon emission, reverse global warming, social activism, and then also inner knowledge, trying to come at it from within, I suppose.
Although I wouldn't say knowledge. I think we're getting to the quick of it now, because I think knowledge is like technology in the sense that it can be misapplied and therefore eventually will be misapplied. And so it can't be relied on. Like, if we depend on knowledge, we end up with Skynet again, you know. Terminator reference there. AI. Like, there's something about compartmentalized knowledge in itself that is no substitute for the thing that we have lost touch with, as a result of the thing that we can't identify, or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe something else has taken us over because we lost touch with something within us, and some sort of surrogate has been created, like, as in, if we have an internal guidance system that we recognize in animals as instinct, we recognize in ourselves as intuition at its, that's kind of its lowest manifestation. Like, we have a sense of something where we know what's what without referring to knowledge. If there's something like that within us that's been hijacked, then maybe it's been replaced with an artificial version of it. So we now have this implant that's guiding us into all the wrong ways of behaving. That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Calvin. The next part will be up next Wednesday, the 18th of October 2017. I'd like to thank Steve for donations this week. I just got my royalties for Seen and Not Seen. I just found out I've sold 149 copies in the last, what's that, 3 years? Yeah, 3 years. 50 copies a year. So that's all of you who's not buying it. I blame you. I see. I'm smiling when I say that, even though I really, really mean it. I'm really pissed off. Just makes me want to give up the whole fucking thing at this point. I should never check the numbers, but they told me to. Obviously, I'm going to find out when I get like $100 for 3 years of royalties. Anyway, I'm saying this to bitch, but also to, in case anyone really thought that I was becoming something other than marginal, fear not. There's no point in saying buy my book, because it just won't work. So I don't know what to say. Well, it's a shame. It's a real crying shame. Actually, now that I think about it, anyone who's donating, I would much rather that they bought the book than that they gave me money. It actually means a lot more to me, this book to sell, than it does getting some money into my PayPal account. So I would just request that instead of donating, you buy Seen and Not Seen. That's it. There's going to be a Sunday meeting on October the 15th. Well, we're going to get together and explore the liminal social realms. Till next time, this is one pissed off, frustrated author who never suffers from writer's block, but suffers from writer's stonewall.